coming up till you said your piece. Oh no, here we go again. These nights just seem to never end. I'm the worst thing that you've ever seen. Then you must have closed your eyes after you met me. What's the point of misery? Why don't you just get rid of me? You used to love me. But you're crying. I know it hurts, but we ain't dying. Oh, quit your crying. We fell in love, but we weren't trying.
For 50 years, the Banri Foundation has supported the continuing education of women at Queen's. Join Banri for its 50th anniversary gala on October 24th at 7 p.m. at the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts. This event marks half a century of empowering women through education. Tickets are free, but registration is required. To reserve your spot, visit the Banri Center's website, follow Banri Center on Facebook and Instagram, or email brc@queensu.ca.
Hello and good morning, everyone. It is now 11 a.m. on Thursday morning. You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, CFRC.ca, broadcasting from the basement of Carruthers Hall on the campus of Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Rue, and you're listening to the CFRC Live Sessions, a show where the Live Sessions crew brings you musical performances recorded right here in CFRC Studio A by artists from in and around Kingston and all around the world. Today we've got a session with a songwriter and Queen's student musician, Michael Zuzek, who's just recorded and released his debut album, Everest. Liam caught up with him to talk about songwriting, performing, and all about the new album. You can find him on Instagram, Michael Zuzek, as one word. To keep up with the CFRC Live Sessions, follow us online. We are at CFRC Live Sessions on YouTube and Instagram, and you can find past performances by a wide variety of guest artists on our YouTube channel. If you would like to join the Live Sessions crew for interviewing, audio tech, filming, videography, audio or video production, or anything else that you can think of, please reach out to us on Instagram, or our email address is livesessions@cfrc.ca. You can also reach out to us if you're an artist who would like to do a live session with us here at the station. If you're interested in sponsoring the CFRC Live Sessions and becoming a proud supporter of one of Kingston's most cutting-edge radio programs, please reach out and let's talk. And of course, don't forget to come back every Thursday at 11 a.m. to catch another new live session that we've done showcasing the best of Kingston's sonically diverse music scene and bringing you touring artists from all around the world. But for now, here comes Liam bringing you our session for this week with Michael Zuzek. Enjoy!
Hi, this is Liam here with CFRC 101.9 live sessions. Today we have Michael Zuzek in with us today.
Hello there. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. I guess we'll just get right into it. You recently played at the Muses Mini Desk concert. I was at the Mansion.
Yep.
Yes.
That was fun Tuesday night.
Yeah, fun Tuesday night. Mm-hmm. You mentioned you retire every August. Was this sort of your out of retirement first show back?
Yeah, it was like the first show back, but I always have retired in August.
Yeah.
So I'm a farmer by trade, technically. It's like my family's cherry farm. So every August, I'm just like, Uncle Jay, you've had me all July. Cherries are done. I'm gone. Right? But yeah, so this summer in particular, finished the show and then retired. So actually, that was my first show back, the Mini Desk.
Yeah. And like, what was that experience like? Because I know they had a few bands out there. Like, they had Jinx and they had, I think, somebody else.
Jinx rocked.
Yeah, they rocked. Well, that's good to hear.
They did.
But then, yeah, sort of what was it like coming back to Kingston as well as when all the students came back to play this big show hosted by Muse Magazine?
It was nice. It was really nice, actually. I have played a bit in Kingston last year and the year prior. But now I work with Muse for my second year on the podcast team, so it's cool that I can like see the behind-the-scenes stuff of how they set everything up and all the hard work they do, and then be a part of it as well. So that was really nice, and there was a lot of like cool bands that I haven't seen play yet in Kingston, Jinx in particular, and I thought it was just a really fun show, actually. Yeah.
So, yeah, now that you mention it, you are a part of Muse Magazine your second year. Mm-hmm. You're also a student at Queens. Mm-hmm. I read on your website that you're in a science degree with a music minor. Mm-hmm. What is that sort of like with sort of balancing that with like the heavy workload that comes along with science and then the music minor? Mm-hmm. Is music always been something you've sort of wanted to pursue?
Yeah, totally. I've been playing piano since I was 5. I did the Royal Conservatory of Music for 12 years, quit once it was COVID. So music's always kind of been what I do. It's kind of been my life. I remember even when I was in elementary school, I used to tell my teachers I'll be a rock star, and I'll like shout them out on stage. Shout out Miss Lesko. I told her that. But yeah, I mean, managing the workload is kind of just what I do. I'm very good at multitasking. I've always done a lot throughout my life, as he would know, you know, especially in high school and coming to this. I think COVID was a big setback for everyone. So I wasn't doing a lot in between like COVID and maybe the past 2 years. But now I'm ramping it back up, and I'm just trying to do everything I can, really. But it's nice. It's hard, but it's nice. Rewarding life.
Yeah, very rewarding. And then, like you said, sort of just like a second nature to
totally
you.
Is, yeah.
Like, built into how you've sort of been raised and everything.
Mm-hmm.
All right, sweet. And so this first song you played for us, The Man Who
Is Never Found,
yes, was the lead-off track from your album. I guess sort of go into like what's sort of the story behind that song there.
Okay, that one, yes, that's the first song on Everest. Kind of the way that song went, I was at my aunt's piano where I wrote about half the album, and I just came up with a chorus, the descending part, because Lennon does that in Dear Prudence, and he goes the other way in Isolation and some other songs. I'm a big Lennon fan, and
the musician, not the political
figure. Yeah, definitely not the political figure. I was like, huh, I like this. I like the descending. I like the fact that you stay in one key and you move. And so I just came up with the little chorus part. And then I kind of sat on it for a bit and then came back and did the verse. But my friend Martin, who plays bass on the song alongside Scott, he likes to interpret it as, you know, oh my God, you're totally getting at like your past life and stuff from high school and love and loss. And sure, I definitely am, but I kind of just wanted to ramble and get lyrics kind of like Bob Dylan, just free flowing. And like, there's not really a bunch of breakage, but it's a nice like 60s kind of rock chord progression with some 60s-esque lyrics. So that's kind of where my head was at for that. And then the bridge, we don't have a lot of like heavy electric guitar on the album, but I knew the bridge needed just to have like some punch, like Zeppelin or something. So we did that pretty good too.
All right, sweet. So this is The Man Who Was Never Found by Michael Zuzek.
Mm-hmm. train, he was surprised when he got her laying in that crowd light. Saw you there crying, and you know that I'd be lying if I didn't want to join. There's a peace that can't be won.
With CFRC 101.9 Live Sessions. That was The Man Who Was Never Found by Michael Zuzek. All right, so your album Everest, you released back in August. Mm-hmm. Was that sort of built on a bunch of songs you had written over your sort of musical career, or did you sit down being like, I want to write an album and I want to process all this stuff that happened with my life, or just work through it and end up creating a project? Or was it something that had kind of been building, or was it like sort of just you sat down and it was a process?
It's definitely a bit of everything, really. Yeah. I wanted to make an album probably come like September of 2021, because I was writing for about a year. And I'm like, okay, I have some stuff in here that I like, some stuff I don't like. And I was like, let's actually make an album. So I thought about it, like, why would I make an album? Well, I would make an album to play kind of the sounds that I grew up on, so like 60s, 70s, 80s, rock and roll, just like smart melodies, smart chord progressions, like meaningful lyrics. And so I started doing that, and it definitely became a way to like process, you know, trauma and changes in life. And I think someone reviewed the album and described it as a story of love, loss, and life, and that's very accurate. I think there's like stories being told, maybe they're not all true about me, but that is the theme across the album, because that is the theme across, you know, everyone's life, and especially what I wanted to discuss in my life. But it was probably a 3-year-long process until I had the 12 songs solidified. But of the 12 that are on Everest, I wrote and started production on 30 of them. So I kind of just cut it down. I was like, well, that's not good. You just know if it's not good, right? And that's how it ended up being. And then I found songs that I liked. And I think they all kind of, like, are very cohesive. They're a very different sound, all of them. But they all kind of do that 60s, 70s instrumentation, I think, in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely listening to the album, you can. I heard the sort of 60s, 70s influences. I found a lot of Supertramp on there.
Yes,
and
yeah.
Definitely a lot of Beatles with Lennon and mm-hmm. the chord progressions and everything. And then particularly the song Greystone, which mm-hmm. you play for us next. I was looking around and I saw that back in June, you released a bunch of singles previously, like before, ahead of time, before the album. Mm-hmm. And I saw the song Greystone charted on the UK iTunes charts. It yeah. was number 19. What was sort of that like what was that experience seeing that and having that pay off?
That, I mean, I don't know. That was kind of weird. I kind of just got a text from my marketing guy and these guys, and they're like, that's fake, right? And I was like, no, I don't think so. I mean, you go on iTunes and you're scrolling and it's like, oh, no, that's real. It was there for like the day and then it kind of faded off and it moves around kind of. That was the first one we cooked. That was the first like song that was fully finished. And we're like, that's the one. That was kind of always the one. Greystone was always like the song. We're like, man, that's the magnum opus. It just sounds like perfect, really. Love the vocal work on that. No drums, but it doesn't need any, right? It's just the piano is the rhythm, really.
Fire.
Yeah. And so that getting on the charts was very strange, very surreal still, but rewarding, I'd say. And also kind of just I try to be humble in life, but having that is kind of just like what would you call it,
push in the right direction.
Yeah It's like this is what I do, like yeah. I'm proud to be rewarded for that. And it's also just something to be like, hey, I'm gonna play some songs for you guys. This one happened to chart, right? It's just maybe more ears will listen that way, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, this is Greystone by Michael Zuzek. This is Liam with CFRC 101.9 Live Sessions. Today we have Michael Zuzek in with us. So that was Grey Stones, wonderful song. Like we said previously, charted on the UK iTunes. Yeah, you also mentioned that on the album you have a lot of 60s, 70s rock influences. I've heard when I listen to it, like Supertramp and a little bit of Zeppelin and stuff like that. But it's interesting to see you sort of in this stripped down setting where it kind of steers away from the sort of 70s, 60s rock and is more, I would say, like, I guess, more Billy Joel or John Lennon's solo work on Imagine and everything. And is that normally how a live show for you goes, or would you say do you get the drums and the bass out?
For a big proper show like we did in August, the full band was there because we played basically everything on the album. A lot of the songs have multiple keyboards, like electric piano part, organ part, to the, you know, Supertramp nod. And I can only play one instrument, unfortunately, right? I don't have four hands. I wish I did, and I don't really like to enlist the other keyboard parts to a lot of other musicians. So I have two wonderful guitarists that played in the band with me, and we kind of figured out how do we put like an organ sound or an organ part onto the guitar, right? So it was strange figuring that out, but for a big show like that, we have everything and it's really powerful. But when it's just me, yeah, it is a bit more Billy Joel-esque or Lennon Plastic Ono Band, right? And I like it like that. I love my keyboard. I do like a real like upright piano because you can really control levels a bit better there and the dynamics of it. But that's kind of what my single shows end up being. I'll play classics and try to get the crowd involved, but I do love just playing big grandiose pieces. Like I've been playing scenes from an Italian restaurant. This week I played that at Muse on Tuesday. So stuff like that, yeah, definitely.
Sweet, that sounds good. Mm-hmm. And this next song coming up, No Other, I guess going back to sort of the writing process and everything, you mentioned with The Man who's never Found was sort of just kind of you wanting to put something out and have it be these sort of Bob Dylan-esque rambling lyrics. Mm-hmm. With this song, No Other, it feels a lot more personal, and
it
definitely is. Mm-hmm. So I guess as you go along through the track list of the albums, would you say it does get more personal and more succinct and more focused on different aspects of your personal life?
That's a great observation, actually.
It is a great observation.
That's a great observation. That's so true, right?
It is true.
Well, okay, yeah, that's very true. The back half of the album has Scott's song, right? So it's the first song we ever recorded that's on the album. That was the first song that made the original cut. And then the other 11 songs got scrapped and Scott's song stayed. Veronica, which is my girlfriend, I wrote her that song. That's on the second side. Greystone's on the second side. I'd Love to Have Your Loving Back Again's on the second side. So yes, it definitely does get more personal. It's a great observation, actually. Yeah.
Would you say that was intentional or just purely accidental as you got deeper and deeper into the process of making the album?
Definitely accidental. Yeah, it just kind of came. I mean, I didn't even pick the track list. The bassist, Marty, he's going to get to Kingston in probably...
He's here now.
He's here. 10 minutes ago, he got here. He picked the track list because we were having trouble figuring it out, and I wanted Greystone to open, and they're like, no, it has to close. And I was like, Martin, I don't have any clue. I don't know what the track list is going to be, and he sent me it. And I was like, okay, that's going to be it. No questions asked? Yeah, Martin, that's good. It's done.
I feel like you were just writing songs, and then your life like eventually just started seeping more and more into them. Do you know what I'm saying?
But yeah, I agree.
That's how the songs sound to me, at least.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. That's exactly what happened. It's just like I said, I wanted to write about my life, and I kind of just was. And then I liked a song or I didn't like a song, right?
Sweet. All right, well, this is No Other by Michael Zuzek.
Like you said, my love, we all need second. no other. Your life is all smiling and faking. Your eyes tell me stay. My life is all thinking and waiting.
I messed up. Can I go? Where can I go from? Are you able to cut in there? Go from wherever? Start over? All right, let me think. I think how it goes, though. Okay, here we go.
My love is all broken and jaded.
Was No Other by Michael Zuzek with CFRC 101.9. So yeah, I guess nearing the end of the session here, you have one more song for us, Veronica. Mm-hmm. I guess just, yeah, what's left is, do you have any shows coming up or anything you'd like to plug or get out there for our listeners?
Yeah, totally. Next Saturday, Clark Hall Pub. Doors open at 8. I'll be playing after the Clay Pigeons open. I should be on around 9. I think everyone should be able to get in at 8:30 if you come at 8. I'll probably be playing for an hour and a half. I'll play half of Everest because, you know, some of the songs you can't completely play on the piano alone. So I'll play half of Everest, and then I'll play a bunch of other fan favorites. I'll also be probably dedicating a fair amount of time to John Lennon, as his birthday is 4 days after the show. So I'll play a lot of, like, Plastic Ono Band, stuff off Imagine, some of the Beatles' best hits, stuff like that. And, yeah, that's about it. Come see me on October 5th, Clark Hall Pub.
All right, you heard that. October 5th, Clark Hall Pub, Michael Zuzek. And yeah, this is Liam, CFRC 1.9 live session theme. That was Michael Zuzek.
I'm Michael Zuzek.
I'm Scott.
You are listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Creative power of people. So the issue of extinction is related very intimately to where do we see creativity to emerge. Does it emerge from constructions, or does it emerge from every part of this planet, every cell in every being? The great illusions of the industrial age, which is also the colonial age, which is also the capitalist age, are first that nature is dead. And right here in this area, you've had Susan Griffin, Caroline Merchant, write so beautifully about the construction of the idea of a dead nature. And if nature is dead, then you can't really kill it. What we have called progress is built on two pillars. One pillar is mechanistic science, the idea that the world is made of objects, lifeless objects, unrelated to each other. And even though the best of science today, whether it comes from biology or it comes from quantum theory, is teaching us that that idea of separation is very false, that we live in a non-separable world. We live in a web of life. We live in a world where one action in one place has huge impact. And what could make this clearer than the fact that the fossil fuel use of the industrialized world is making the glaciers retreat in the Himalaya, where no one uses fossil fuel. The Ganges Glacier is retreating at 20 meters a year. Last year, we had such extreme rain in 2 days, the 16th and 17th of June, 350% more than normal. The glaciers were already melting and lakes had formed. With this heavy rain, the lakes burst. I come from a very beautiful part of the Himalaya where the Ganges originates. The region is called Chardham. It's also called Devbhumi. Devbhumi means the place of the gods. Chardham is the pilgrimage to the five tributaries of the Ganges, each of which is a goddess, each of which has a temple at the source. And it's been a protected region because these rivers were seen as sources of life. A few years ago, partly because of climate change, suddenly there was a spate of dam building because dams are now defined as a clean development mechanism. And when you build a dam, you can get money. 500 dams are planned on the Ganges. About 30 have been built. Dams as well as hydroelectric projects. And the state was renamed from Devbhumi, the land of the divine, to Urja Pradesh, the land of energy. Hydroelectric power. Well, these 15-kilometer, 30-kilometer tunnels that are built excavate the mountain. They blast with dynamite. And when this flood came last year, all of that debris in the river was carried with the flood waters, and our rivers, river beds, rose by 40 feet in some places, which meant that villages that were sitting safe were now washed away. Bridges that were 30 feet above the water were washed away. 20,000 people died. None of them had caused the instability of which they were a victim. And this interconnectedness then creates a collective responsibility. How do we start building that collective responsibility? Partly by becoming more real about the world in which we are. More real about a planet that is alive. More real about the fact that we are members of the Earth family. More real about the fact that every species has rights. And when we've built a mechanistic science, a reductionist paradigm based on fragmentation and separation, of course, no species have rights. They're just objects to be manipulated. And this idea of the ultimate manipulation has reached its peak, the idea of genetic engineering. The claim is that this is the next step of the so-called Green Revolution. The Green Revolution, as I've said often, was not green and not revolutionary. It was just a clever way to deploy war chemicals to agriculture. And very often, it has been said, India's food doubled and tripled. No. All that happened is instead of growing a diversity of crops, we grew rice in one season and wheat in one season. If all you grow is rice, you'll have more rice. It doesn't matter what the seed is like. So what was made a miracle seed was not really a miracle. It was the result of having more irrigation and putting more land under a crop. Native varieties of seeds have everything going for them. The only thing is they don't like chemicals. So when you apply chemicals, they have a habit of lodging. I call it the force of truth of the plant saying, go away, chemicals, I don't want you. But instead of saying chemicals are wrong, we don't need them in agriculture, the chemical industry said, let's change the plant. And they made them dwarf so they could absorb chemical fertilizers more. But they needed more water, 10 times more water. Norman Borlaug called the 12 people he sent out to distribute these seeds and push the chemicals. He called them his 12 apostles. And now there are people writing about Norman Borlaug being declared a saint. Borlaug got a Nobel Peace Prize for spreading these seeds and chemicals. But I got involved in agriculture because of the violence in Punjab. 30,000 people were killed. Punjab was a land of war. Today, Punjab has lost its water. People give about 5 to 10 years more of the drilling. They've gone down some places to 1,000 feet. The soils are dead. Farmers are dying. Some because they're getting cancer. There's actually a train that leaves Punjab called the cancer train. It's got the name cancer train. And they have to leave in a train because there's a hospital that's charitable that's been built in Rajasthan by the Jains. But the others are dying because of debt. The argument has been made that genetically engineered seeds are the second green revolution. And if the myth of the green revolution works, then the myth of the second green revolution should also work. The difference is that when the green revolution started to make the Punjab farmers pay a price with their very lives, it's only they who knew. And that's why they took to arms and guns and created the protests that then led to the army being sent to the Golden Temple. Today with GMOs, everyone gets connected. It's not just an issue of a little part, one little region called Punjab. I'm sure most of you don't even know that Punjab had violence. Most of you probably don't know that 6 times more people were killed in Punjab than in 9/11. And that the injustice of to the people of Punjab carries on because the military was sent, then Indira Gandhi was assassinated, and then the 3,006 were killed in a pogrom. And the justice still hasn't been done. The same year we had the Bhopal disaster, and there too no justice has been done. It's the 30th anniversary. It's a good moment to remember that the poisons that are made to look inevitable in agriculture were never meant for food systems. They were meant to kill human beings, and they're killing human beings another life. Because I did a study on the Green Revolution, I got involved in the genetic engineering debate through a conference in 1987 organized in Geneva, where the industry laid out, the old agrochemical industry said, we've got to genetically engineer the seed in order to take patents on seed, and we've got to do this worldwide, so we've got to have a world intellectual property rights law. Monsanto later admitted that they wrote that law. They said, we were the patient, diagnostician, physician, all in one. We defined a problem, and what was the problem? That farmers save seeds. And they offered a solution, and the solution was seed saving should be made an intellectual property crime. Now, at that meeting, they really had hoped by the year 2000, GMOs would have taken over the whole world. But we started to build movements for seed freedom and seed sovereignty. And that meant both with love, taking care of every seed we could find, and making sure farmers could have the seeds to grow food without chemicals, without debt. I regret that I did not look at fiber at that time. I looked at food. So we saved food crops and vegetables and pulses. Monsanto came in with the GM cotton. And it came in illegally. It entered India illegally as it enters most countries illegally. Entered Brazil illegally. It's entering Bangladesh illegally. Because legally, it's not so easy. We have laws in most of the world. The only country that doesn't have laws for biosafety. Biosafety is an assessment of environmental impact, public health impact, and socioeconomic impact in the context of genetically engineered organisms. There's a United Nations treaty on this, and when we got the article in the Convention on Biological Diversity, it's Article 19.3, President Bush Sr. walked out and said, I won't let my biotech industry lose profits. And came back, and then I always laugh and I think of Dan Quayle because he couldn't spell potato. But he did manage to spell substantial equivalence, which is the assumption that genetically engineered organisms are like parent organisms. There's no difference. And therefore, you don't have to look, you don't have to see, you'll never find impact. And you declare safety. There is no law in this country on assessment of genetically modified organisms. No law at all. The BT crops have been approved as a pesticide. And the industry sends a note to the government to say, we're bringing this variety, approve it. That's how the new Dow varieties that are resistant to 2,4-D have been recently introduced. Of course, the interesting thing is that the same companies, when it comes to safety, they say just like nature made it. And when it comes to ownership, they say never existed in nature before, totally our invention. I've called this ontological schizophrenia. You've split the world into two for the same object. New when it comes to owning, natural when it comes to running away from taking responsibility of the impacts. We've seen the impacts now in 20 years. The first impact is, of course, the fact of two applications, BT toxin crops and herbicide tolerant crops. Neither of them have succeeded. One has created super pests, the other has created super weeds, and American agriculture is a good evidence of the failure with 17 million acres under super weeds. In India, the impact is the fact that because GMOs have only one objective, there might be a claim that they are about feeding the world, the reality is it's about collecting royalties. And it's collecting royalties from what nature does. Because nature reproduces one generation of seed. That work is not done by the gene that was introduced. Life makes itself. And in the case of life, the idea of intellectual property rights is such a deep violation of the rights of nature. It's a violation of the rights of farmers, and it is increasingly in this country becoming a violation of rights of all citizens. It's a violation of nature because what is being claimed as property is the reproductive capacity of living organisms.
On Wings, you're listening to Dr. Vandana Shiva, speaking in Berkeley, California, in October 2014.
Besides building movements, besides going to courts, I also went to Geneva to talk to ambassadors and say, you know, this is what your intellectual property rights looks like. It allows companies to steal from other cultures. And I remember the ambassador of the U.S. said, we are committed to defining life as a manufacturer because this is where the future of the U.S. economy lies. So this very foundational redefinition of taking the mechanistic worldview into life itself has been defined as the area of growth. How does the growth take place? Through intellectual property, through collecting rents and royalties. But that growth is not distributed through society. This idea of a mechanistic worldview is now being imposed at a time where science tells you that it's about relationships. That's where creativity is taking place in all life, including human life. What has been done is a trick I call the imposition of a creation boundary. You just decide that nature doesn't create, people don't create, capital enters, and suddenly there's creation. And this has made a difference to how we live our lives, but it's the foundations of the economic theory. Just the other day, I was trying to make sense of how is it that we've reached a place where we declare capital, which is a construct, as the creative force that creates value and wealth, and nature has been reduced to land, which is just a commodity and a dead input, and people have been reduced to labor, which is another inert input. We need to turn that equation on its head. Nature's creative, people are creative. Capital is another word for money, and money is a means which should be subjected to higher values. And I would say the same for technology. I mean, the two tools, two means, money and technology, have been elevated to creative forces of the universe. And the creative forces of the universe have been dumped into a garbage can. And no wonder we have so much destruction. No wonder we have so much exploitation. No wonder we have the death of democracy. In terms of the technology tool, genetic engineering can do nothing without a living organism. It doesn't create the living organism, it has to use a living organism. And the living organism is usually seed stolen from someone else.
On Wings, you're listening to Vandana Shiva, who led a successful campaign from 1997 to 2001 to quash a company's patent on India's famous basmati rice.
I've had to deal with patents on basmati, but also a patent on wheat. Everyone now has gluten allergies. But we've eaten wheat throughout human history. And in India, we still have wheats that don't contribute to gluten allergy. There's a silencing gene. So Monsanto, of course, thought, what a brilliant market. Patent these old varieties. And the patent said, the wheat, all products are made of the wheat, the dough made from the wheat, the cookies made of the wheat. And they had hoped to capture a global market. But we challenged the patent. And in this case, we didn't even have to fight. We had to do no arguments. We had no court case. They ran. They dropped the patent and ran. But it doesn't mean that biopiracy has stopped. Because of the fear of climate change, of course, there's a premium on crops that are resilient to drought and floods and salt that comes from the oceans during hurricanes and cyclones. And I remember an ad that had been put in all the newspapers and magazines by Monsanto saying, climate change, 9 billion people, what now? And then they moved on to say only they can create climate resilience. They can't create climate resilience. Climate resilience is a multi-genetic trait. Genetic engineering can only move genes. The technology is crude. Most people don't know that gene transfer takes place through only two steps of violence against the cells of an organism. One is shooting with a gene gun, and the other is infecting with a plant cancer. And it's a very uncertain technology. You don't know if it'll succeed. That's why you have antibiotic resistance markers, viral promoters, all evidence that you don't know what you're doing. And yet they say the most accurate, precise technology ever. In the case of climate resilience, because in Navdanya we save seeds, when these claims started that, oh, we are making salt-tolerant seeds for the first time, we started putting out lists of all the salt-tolerant seeds we have that have been bred by farmers, given by nature, evolved by farmers. When the supercyclone hit Orissa, 30,000 people killed, we were able to rejuvenate agriculture through these salt-tolerant seeds. And the farmers of Orissa gave 2 truckloads to the farmers of Tamil Nadu during the tsunami. Indonesian farmers took these salt-tolerant seeds. Burmese farmers wanted them, but the junta at that time didn't allow the giving of the seeds. So climate-resilient traits are not an invention of the biotech industry. And I feel very proud that our patent office rejected a Monsanto application for climate resilience. They said, you've invented nothing. There is, of course, huge pressure. There's something called Special 301 in your trade law, which is an act that can threaten us. We are being threatened right now, and our Prime Minister and Mr. Obama signed an agreement that we will do something with our intellectual property rights of the kind that allow us to say to Monsanto, sorry, you didn't invent salt tolerance or stress tolerance or climate resilience. But there are 1,500 patents by the 5 companies that control the chemicals and now the seeds for climate resilience. So if they don't breed climate resilient crops, what do they do? They've now moved to big data. Everywhere you hear the talk of big data. So big data is, they take seeds from gene banks where it's very clearly written on the passport data, salt tolerant, drought tolerant, flood tolerant. So they know this. Seeds have these traits. Then they put it through reading the genome in some totally mechanical computer act. And then as is written, then we make a guess. Which are the 100 winning lottery tickets? Because they're making a guess of what part of the genome contributes to the trait. They don't know. They're betting. They've turned life to a casino. And they're taking patents on this betting. If Wall Street brought the world down in 2008 with a financial casino, can you imagine what the implications are if seed is allowed to be in the hands of those who have no idea what that seed is? And not only is it about monopoly on seed, Monsanto's just bought up the biggest climate data corporation, Climate Core. They bought up the world's biggest soil data corporation because the vision is a huge centralized system where every farmer at every point will have to buy information. And with that information, the particular patented seed. It would be a bad idea even if it worked. But it can't work because nature's so diverse, soils are diverse, our crops are diverse, the seasons are changing. And it's only adaptation at the local level that's able to respond. Not a centralized system where big data becomes the means of control. because of WTO and globalization, all that used to be measured is how much grain is in container ships. You know, when WTO says we'll increase trade by 200 billion, all they're doing is measuring the up and down. They're not measuring how much is growing, and they're not measuring how much is being eaten. Now, in terms of being eaten, it now turns out that 70% of the food people eat grows in small farms, family farms, and gardens. And this, in spite of the fact that for 50 years, all we've had is policies for pushing corporate-controlled industrial agriculture. In spite of that, 70% food comes from the small. Look at the data. Russia, 56% family farms produce 90% of the potatoes, 55% of the milk. In Brazil, 87% of the beans and milk come from small farms. Cuba, it's 98%. Ukraine, 55%. You could go through every country. Most of the food eaten by people comes from small farms. Small farms are the base of food security. We've done a lot of work saving seeds, growing biodiversity, and a few years ago, we started to calculate the nutrition that was being produced. We called it health per acre. And we can feed two Indias by conserving biodiversity. The world could feed two times the population. That issue of scarcity and then, you know, 10 billion, 9 billion, get scared, accept GMOs, is so out of tune with what the facts are. Now, while industrial farming produces only 30% of the food, and GMO corn and soya only 10%, they are destroying 75% of the planet. 75% biodiversity has been eroded because of industrial monocultures. This is United Nations Plant Genetic Resources Convention in 1995. From 95 to now, it's worse, because we've had globalization and spread larger monocultures. 70% of the water, 75% of the water is misused. I would not say used. Misused in industrial farming. Misused both because plants don't need that level of water, but also because the runoff that carries the chemicals is then creating the dead zones. Soil degradation because of chemical industrial farming. 40% of the greenhouse gases, the combination of carbon dioxide, nitrogen oxide from nitrogen fertilizers, methane from factory farming, as well as the fact that this globalized system of an agriculture based on uniformity is wasting 50% of the food. And that food also goes into waste dumps, garbage dumps, and emits methane. 40% of the climate problem is related to how we are violating the rights of the earth in how we grow our food. And in the process, not feeding people either, 1 billion people are hungry, 2 billion suffering from diseases related to bad food.
You have been listening to Dr. Vandana Shiva, scientist, feminist, and ecological activist, October 20th, 2014, in Berkeley, California. The second part will be released in a later program. The website for the Navdanya Institute is www.navdanya.org. Wings thanks radio station KPFA for use of its audio. For Wings, I'm Kelia Ramirez Watson in Berkeley, California.
Tune in next week for the rest of Vandana Shiva's powerful speech in California.
We'll have to be more brilliant than we've ever been, more resilient than we've ever been, more courageous than we've ever been.
To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org, and please like our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Thanks to all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving,